Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Have been arrested in Baghdad and charged with the kidnapping of American journalist Jill Carroll. Carroll is a 28-year-old stringer for the Christian Science Monitor who was kidnapped in January in an ambush west of Fallujah that left her driver dead. She was released 2.5 months later. Louise Rogue of the Los Angeles Times is in Baghdad. Louise, start by telling us a little bit, about Jill Carroll's alleged captors. Where were they arrested?
So far, there are a few details coming from the American military who announced the arrest today. What is clear is that it took place west of Baghdad in the volatile Anbar province and was done by U.S. Marines. Now, I was told just a little while ago by a U.S. military spokesman that, in fact, the men have been held in custody for at least a month.
Oh.
So why we're now hearing about the fact that they have these suspected kidnappers in their custody, why now?
That is interesting. We understand that a Marine went to investigate a house he'd read about and detained the owner, and then subsequently they found other members of this alleged group, the Revenge Brigade, and in so doing also released two hostages. This according to some reporting that's coming across the wires. But had you heard about this Revenge Brigade before?
When they surfaced after the kidnapping in January, they were unknown. And their demands were, at the time, that the U.S. should release all the women detainees in Iraq. It was also a demand that was new. So very little was known of them, and it's unclear if they were, in fact, related to al-Qaeda or any other organization like that.
Well, the Christian Science Monitor has released a statement saying that Jill Carroll and her colleagues are grateful for the efforts of the U.S. government, both to secure Jill's freedom and to find her kidnappers. And they say everything possible needs to be done to relieve Iraqis and others of this scourge. Jill is going to be writing about her kidnapping in the Monitor next week. But in the meantime, is there any speculation as to why the captors might have been held for a month and what's to happen to them now?
I think the American and Iraqi authorities are trying to discuss different options in terms of prosecution, and that the military spokesman said today a decision will be made shortly.
We just want to touch on the topic of kidnappings. Figures released by the Washington-based Brookings Institution show that 268 foreigners have been kidnapped since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Of those, 44 have been killed, 135 released. A lion's share of those kidnapped are Iraqis. Is there a sense that there's an effort to find those kidnappers?
I was just interviewing a man who had been held for 3 days, and he had dealt with American authorities and was sort of critical of their efforts. Thousands and thousands of Iraqis have been kidnapped, and many never make it back despite the family paying ransoms. It's just a toll that keeps increasing, and many of these people are kidnapped, often by men in uniform, posing as police or actual police, militias who have infiltrated the police.
Well, in fact, while you're in Baghdad, we wanted to ask you about the new security operation there, new U.S. troops sent to Baghdad to defend against sectarian violence and specifically to try to curb these kidnappings. We're hearing that this is sort of a make-or-break bid to quell sectarian violence in Baghdad. What is your sense of what's happening there now?
Well, we've got the arrival of several thousand American troops from up north in Mosul, and deployment of Iraqi troops from elsewhere as well. So added troop presence on the street. But it's hard to see exactly how this is going to change in the long run. Every time the American military has gone in any area, in any city, at a certain moment, they've just chosen to leave again, at which point violence has resumed. So it's hard to see how this is going to be effective in the long term.
And yet in the short term, we're hearing some analysts say that this is, you know, sort of a make-or-break moment in Baghdad. Do you get the sense of that, that if the U.S. fails to stave off the sectarian violence, then the insurgents have won?
I mean, I think the most interesting development here in the last couple of days was a U.S. raid in the Shia slum of Sada City. Now, they were raiding what was believed to be exactly some sort of kidnapping cell, militias, exactly those kinds of people that they want to clamp down on. And immediately after, the prime minister came out, was quite critical of the American military, as was the president. I think Maliki even said, you know, this is not going to happen again. So the U.S. and the Iraqi government seems to be at odds here at what kind of measures can be taken and how they want to deal with the militias.
Because as we mentioned on the program yesterday, the raid was against members of the Mahdi army, allegedly, and the Mahdi army, under the direction of Muqtada al-Sadr, is closely affiliated with the current Iraqi government.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about this current government is that Prime Minister Maliki is of a party that doesn't have a militia. Now, Maliki isn't backed by any kind of militia and has relied on the backing of Sadr. It's hard to see him really standing up to Sadr and clamping down on the mighty army. And I think it's an uphill road here for the Americans.
Louise Rogue, Baghdad correspondent for the LA Times in Baghdad. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
To Cuba now, where neither Fidel Castro nor his brother Raul have been seen in public since Fidel temporarily transferred power to his younger brother 2 weeks ago. Cuban officials continue to insist that the longtime Cuban leader, who turns 80 on Sunday, will recover from intestinal surgery. Last night in Havana, crowds shouted, "Long live Fidel! Long live Raul!" This week, journalist Christopher Hitchens on Slate.com called what's happening in Cuba a military coup. Whether or not that's true, the question is, what is happening? We turn now to journalist Alma Guillermo Prieto. She writes about Latin America for The New Yorker magazine and the New York Review of Books and is known for her unique journalistic voice. As a dancer in the 60s, she trained with Martha Graham and Twyla Tharp. She left New York in 1970 to teach dance in Cuba for 6 months and described her experiences and a turning point in the Cuban Revolution in her 2004 memoir, Dancing with Cuma. Well, Alma Guillermo Prieto joins us on the line from her home in Mexico City. Welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, what are you hearing out of Cuba these days from friends or from reports that you're picking up?
Well, like everybody else, very little. There was a very interesting news report this week coming out of Cuba where we saw Roberto Fernandez, who is a very old person and a longtime member of the Cuban Communist Party, speaking before an audience at a Congress and saying they said that without Fidel, this country would collapse, and he isn't around right now, and the country hasn't collapsed, and they said that we could never have a peaceful transition of power in Cuba, and we have had a peaceful transition of power. That was the first time the phrase had been used by anybody in the higher ranks of the Cuban establishment. So that was very interesting. Talking to my Cuban friends here and there, they're as confused and as wondering as the rest of us, a little more inclined perhaps to think that Fidel might be having his little joke or having a little rehearsal. My own particular inclination is to think that he's A, not dead, and C, not conducting a dress rehearsal of a transition of power. I think he is sick.
Well, you read the tea leaves in Cuba from a special vantage point. As we said, you were in 1970. You spent 6 months there as a dance teacher. And you write that even at your age then of 21, you couldn't go swoony about Cuba. What were people swooning about at the time, and what did you see that made you resist?
I tried to go all swoony about Cuba, and I failed because maybe because I'm not a swoony type. But the actual achievements of the Cuban Revolution in its first 10 years, which is when I was there, were remarkable, particularly if you were a poor Latin American or poor Cuban. Health conditions improved extraordinarily. Education became very efficient and universal and very democratic. We do not have a democratic society in any of the Latin American countries. We had highly stratified class systems. And the very idea that everybody might be poor but might be equally poor is very, very powerful. So I think those were the two main gifts of the Cuban regime to the Cuban people. In addition to the fact that Fidel Castro has been an unconscionably charismatic and attractive figure, particularly in his early years when he was young and dashing.
Unconscionably?
Well, you know, it's sort of not fair for somebody to have those good looks, that much self-assurance, that ability to hypnotize an audience. Other politicians around the world must have looked at him and just gnashed their teeth, you know, thinking, how does he do this?
Especially since there were victims, those who were exiled, those who lost
yes.
their place, you know, in his wake.
Oh, absolutely. One-tenth of the Cuban population, one-sixth of the Cuban population, depending on how you count, fled Cuba. And yet, despite that, he continued to have this enormous charismatic hold on, I would say, a majority.
But you were there at a time of a crisis in the revolution. I read that you were there during the 10 million ton harvest, for instance. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yes, well, that was sort of, you know, the kind of chutzpah that Fidel had that allowed him to dare to ask people to do the impossible thing and then get away with it, even when it turned out to be impossible. He had decided in 1970, or actually he had decided quite a few years earlier, that the way that Cuba could wrest its economic independence from the Soviet Union, which he very much resented being so beholden to, was by harvesting more sugar than had ever been harvested in Cuba, and this would be 10 million tons of sugar. And in order to do that, what he did was turn the country upside down and have everyone from government bureaucrats to haircutters, to government haircutters, because everything was run by the government, go out and cut sugarcane.
Did you have to participate?
No, fortunately, I did not participate because, very conveniently, I have to say, I had gotten pneumonia.
But the dancers, you would have had to. I mean, the whole ballet corps.
Yes, but not only would I have had to, I would have been thrilled to participate. You know, this was a sacred cause. It wasn't just going out and cutting some sugar cane. And Fidel has always been extraordinarily skillful at mobilizing people for a cause.
But he didn't.
And then what happened in May of 1970 is that we all went to the plaza to hear him speak July 26th on the anniversary to say, we failed, this is a mess, the Cuban economy is in tatters, and I say, if you want me to quit, I will quit. And of course, in that state of sort of euphoria and tears and everything else, everybody yells, no, don't quit. So here he is, 36 years later.
Well, he didn't get you, though. What? Why do you think you had defenses against that charisma? You know, because you left soon after.
Yeah, well, I didn't have all that many defenses, but I had some. Maybe because I hadn't up to that point in my life felt guilty about being an artist. I thought that being an artist was the greatest thing you could possibly be in my own arrogant, youthful way. And the idea that being an artist was being a superficial parasite of society, which is very much what the Cuban thinking was at that time, didn't fit all that well with me.
That's journalist and dancer Alma Guillermo Prieto, who writes about Latin America for The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books. After a quick break, she will imagine a Cuba without Fidel. Also, this quick reminder later in the program, a review of Oliver Stone's new movie, World Trade Center. Much more coming up here and now. Her memoir, Dancing with Cuba, she recalls spending a difficult 6 months teaching dance in Cuba in 1970 during a turning point in Castro's revolution. She then left Cuba and danced to cover Latin America as a journalist, most recently for The New Yorker magazine and The New York Review of Books. Alma, you've written about Fidel Castro's relationship with the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. I want to touch on that because there's a practical aspect. Chavez and Venezuelans pay Castro with cash for Cuban products. Also, Chavez lets Castro buy oil cheaply. But in return, Castro gives Chavez 30,000 Cuban professionals. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, one of the great achievements, again, of the Cuban regime has been to train a surplus of doctors. I don't know how many countries in the world can actually boast that they have a surplus of doctors. And so Fidel has sent Cuban doctors to Venezuela, to Bolivia. There are some here in Mexico, I believe. And this is a source of income for Cuba, and it's a source of prestige. Mm.
These internacionalistas, as they're called, right? It's not just doctors.
Right.
You're right, sports coaches, teachers, literacy experts. And you give us, you, as usual, you write about the details, these little details. For instance, you know, when some of these people are working abroad, they'll do anything to get items back into Cuba for their family.
Yes, the way the Cuban economy has evolved over the last 10 years, or after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, essentially, is very depressing because it seems to have reinstated all of the terrible habits and customs that, and injustices that existed before the Cuban Revolution. So if you have dollars in Cuba right now, you can actually purchase a lot of things, stockings or sanitary napkins or a scotch or refrigerators, but if you don't have access to dollars, then you can't have access to any of those things. So if a family is lucky enough to have a Cuban doctor or a Cuban teacher or a Cuban sports trainer working abroad somewhere, they depend on that person to bring back the fruits of civilization with them.
You quote a friend of yours, a Cuban friend, as saying, years ago, people used to volunteer abroad in these programs out of idealism. Nowadays, our main goal is to carry, to bring the stuff back in.
Yes, I would qualify that now. I would say that a great many are cynical about the revolution because they're not allowed to take their families with them. You know, this is sort of the chip that guarantees the highly trained doctor's return. But at the same time, I would say that there is probably an equal number of doctors who really feel that they have a mission.
Well, there's where you hit upon one of the complicated things about Cuba. You know, because you're right there, both sides of the coin, people who might be forced to do something or feel they have no choice, so they're going to get as much as they can out of it, you know, bring product back into the country, and people who do it because they actually believe in the revolution. You've asked the question, who knows Cuba? Do you have an answer?
In a sense, the exile community knows Cuba as much as the fervent believers do. You know, the exile community knows a Cuba that no longer exists, but which is the root of the Cuba that exists today. We're all the product of our past. And they don't have a clue, I think, as to what Cuba is like today or why Fidel might still have significant support among poor Cubans. Every time I see on television a poor Cuban without electricity because power lines are so completely collapsed saying, you know, we love Fidel because he's done so much for the poor, I really gasp. And then I think, well, I certainly don't know Cuba, you know, no matter how much I may have thought about it. Who else doesn't know Cuba? Well, I think the U.S. government doesn't know Cuba. And Fidel certainly knows a lot, you know. He's still there.
Well, Alma Guillermo Prieto, you've also said you're less interested in the news than what happens to people after the news. We're in the middle of the news right now trying to figure out what the headline is with Fidel. What do you think will happen after the news?
You know, for a long time, I've been sort of waiting for the moment when I will go back to Havana and see this very painful transition take place. I have no doubt that it will be enormously painful.
How so?
Well, you know, people witnessing the end of a system they've lived under their entire lives.
So you mean painful like mourning or painful like, as we've heard, protest over economic reform? Or
I think a combination of all of those. Painful as in mourning, painful as in great fear of what comes next. Painful as in the sense perhaps of lives wasted. You know, people who have trained in socialist economic systems now being completely useless. I think the levels of pain will be many. But I always thought that this was going to happen, you know, like very dramatically, like it does in the movies. Boom, Fidel is gone. But it seems to be happening in slow-mo. And what I do know will happen for sure is that this country that has been Washington's obsession for nearly a half a century will become completely unimportant.
Unimportant.
Yes. I want to ask you, when was the last time you thought about El Salvador? The United States was tremendously concerned with what was happening there in terms of dominoes collapsing and communism taking over. And I think that, unhappily, this is going to be Cuba's fate as well. It will sort of disappear. It'll be the Dominican Republic. It'll be someplace to go for a cheap vacation. And its glorious epic, you know, which is part of what has kept Cubans going all this time, I think, the idea that they were making history, will just melt into a puddle.
Journalist Alma Guillermo Prieto, speaking to us from her home in Mexico City. Again, she wrote the 2004 memoir Dancing with Cuba and writes about Latin America for The New Yorker magazine and The New York Review of Books. And again, there has been no sign of either Fidel Castro or his younger brother Raul Castro in Havana. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The Museum of Science as an independent candidate in November's Connecticut Senate race. This after Lieberman lost the Democratic primary last night to businessman Ned Lamont. Lamont taking 52% of the vote to Lieberman's 48% and gained support by attacking Lieberman for supporting the Iraqi war. As an independent, Lieberman will face Lamont and Republican challenger Alan Schlesinger on the November ballot. Lieberman told the CBS Early Show today he'll find support among voters who did not turn out for the primary.
Less than 15% of the registered voters voted. A little more than 7% of the registered voters voted for my opponent. I think this is so important a decision going forward for our future that all the voters should have that choice.
Well, in other primary races yesterday, Georgia Representative Cynthia McKinney lost a runoff for the Democratic nomination. And in Michigan, moderate Republican Congressman Joe Schwartz lost to a conservative in a GOP primary. Are these races reflecting an anti-incumbent move across the country, or is it just anti-those incumbents? Well, to look ahead, we turn to Boston Globe reporter Rick Klein. He joins us from Connecticut, where he's been covering that primary race. And Rick, first of all, what's been the reaction to Lieberman's loss from the party?
Well, we're seeing state and national party leaders lining up behind Lamont almost to a person. There have not been any that I know of yet of the prominent elected officials, either at the state level or the national level, who are casting their lot with Lieberman. They're saying the voters of Connecticut have spoken. Almost all of these folks, of course, supported Joe Lieberman until yesterday, but they say now that Ned Lamont is the nominee, that he is their guy, and they're going to work on his behalf, even if that means working against Joe Lieberman.
They seeming to say they have to go with the vote of the people, but are they worried about what Lieberman was saying, that maybe not all the people voted?
I did not hear that from anyone other than Joe Lieberman today.
Yeah.
They're saying is that the voters of Connecticut sent a clear message, even if it's a message that these particular elected officials and obviously Joe Lieberman would disagree with. The message is taken. They're viewing it as an anti-George Bush message. They say maybe it's unfair that Joe Lieberman was tagged as so close to George Bush, but that was the message, certainly the message of Ned Lamont's campaign, and they feel like that bodes well for their chances, both in Connecticut and nationwide, but they feel like the man to lead the party at the top of the ticket for the Senate race is Ned Lamont, not Joe Lieberman.
Well, does it bode well for the Republicans as well? Let's just stay with this race for a second, because there are three important House races in Connecticut where Republican incumbents are facing challenges. You say the fact that Lieberman is on the ballot could help them?
Yeah, I think there's a real good chance of that. I think for these Republicans, they're going to be running on a campaign platform that's pretty close to Joe Lieberman's, that there's support for the Iraq War, some support for the president's policies, but obviously being critical of it in others. And they can say, if voters are pressing them on being too close to the president, say, look, I'm just as close to the president as Joe Lieberman, the 18-year Democratic incumbent senator. What we need is more moderate voices. They can run on that same moderate message that Joe Lieberman is bringing, such high profile, making such a high profile part of his campaign.
By the way, Lieberman has said that he'll switch back to the Democratic Party after running as an independent if he wins. And we hear House leaders have said he can have back his seats. He has, you know, he's senior and he has many seats on many committees. But your thoughts briefly before we move on to other races. Do you think he can win as an independent? What's your sense?
Well, two schools of thought. And they say the polls have shown, the pre-primary polls have shown universally that Lieberman would be the clear favorite in a three-way race because he's so many Republicans would be prepared to support him because the Republican candidate is pretty little known, and a lot of independents go to support him as well. However, the big caveat here is we're seeing all of these prominent Democrats line up behind Ned Lamont, is that all the momentum, the fundraising dollars, certainly the tenor of the campaign shifts in a hurry. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a poll that comes out, the next round of public polling shows this race a lot tighter than we have in the past. Maybe Lieberman's still ahead, but maybe by just a handful of points against Ned Lamont, now that all the institutional support heads in another direction.
Well, and I'm sorry if you've said this, but just to be sure, is it possible that, you know, in the state that was assured, a Democratic senator, that this might split the Democrats and a Republican would win because of that?
I think the conventional wisdom is that the Republicans would have to find another candidate than their current candidate, who's gotten into some trouble early on. A little mini scandal about using a false name at one of Connecticut's Indian casinos. That's been a major distraction. If they were able to recruit someone else, and there aren't that many high-profile Connecticut Republicans who could pull it off, if they are able to recruit someone else and push out Alan Schlesinger, then I think all of a sudden that would be a seat that's possible for them to pick up.
Okay, well, let's look nationwide. A new Washington Post ABC News poll shows there's a strong anti-incumbent mood across the country. 55% of voters saying they approve of their lawmaker, but that's a drop of 7 percentage points since May, the lowest level since 1994. So are these races we've been talking about, both Lieberman and, of course, Cynthia McKinney in Georgia, are these bellwethers, or is this about, in particular, let's say, Lieberman?
Well, obviously, these races are determined on local issues. But I think if you're looking for a national trend off of yesterday's primaries, where you see two Democrats and one Republican losing, the national message is that this is a tough year to be an incumbent. Particularly in Lieberman's case, I think the message to read is it's a tough year to be an incumbent who's at all supportive of President Bush and his policies. And when you add to that a Democratic state like Connecticut, it's a very, very potent mix. I think this is the first major indication, yesterday's results nationwide in these three races that you referenced, is the first indication of just how real the anger is out there at the people who are in power. I mean, I've talked to a lot of voters over the last couple of days, a lot of Lamont supporters who say it's not even the war in Iraq as much as gas prices that upset them. And that's one reason they feel like Lieberman hasn't done enough on that front. And so there's just so many issues right now that are making this a scenario that looks like it could be a pretty bloody day for incumbents in November.
Well, let's take a look at another race. The Rhode Island Senate primary, which is set for September 12th, is a reverse, you know, sort of a mirror image of Connecticut. In Rhode Island, freshman Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee is facing Cranston Mayor Stephen Laffey. Chafee, pro-abortion rights, pro-gay marriage. He's voted against the president's tax cuts, the war in Iraq, Supreme Court Justice Alito's nomination, and Bush himself. So you would think that Republicans would not want him back in office. So how are Republicans responding to him?
Well, actually, the Republican powers that be, Karl Rove, raised money for him. The Republican National Committee is trying to save his job. He's got a primary challenger next month, and I think, I mean, their calculation certainly is that because Rhode Island is such a Democratic state, a Republican who is any less moderate, any more conservative than Lincoln Chafee has no chance of holding on to that seat.
Right. Whatever anger they have at him, unlike Connecticut, they could really, you know, lose that seat if he's not running.
That's right. They're taking it very, very seriously. They're pumping a lot of money in to try to defeat the Republican challenger, Mayor Steve Laffey. He's actually got the support of the Club for Growth, which is a conservative group that has in the past challenged moderates. That they were involved in the Schwartz campaign in Michigan, and they were also involved in the challenge against Arlen Specter in Pennsylvania 2 years ago.
And Rick Klein, one last question. We just have a few seconds, but Democrats have been criticized for not being able to convey a message to voters. Does it look like their fortunes may be changing after Connecticut, or does this muddy the waters even more?
Well, this is going to take a couple of days to shake out. I think everyone in the political realm is trying to figure out exactly what the implications are from this and whether it is something that actually will change the party's messages. I think a lot of the 08 presidential candidates are watching this very, very carefully. I think to the extent that it crystallizes something, it crystallizes the need to run against George Bush if you're a Democrat this year. And I think that was a message that was already widely out there, maybe just confirmed now by the results of yesterday.
Rick Klein of the Boston Globe on the trail in Hartford, Connecticut. Rick, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. And we got an earful after yesterday's conversation with blogger and University of Michigan professor Juan Cole. Cole said, among other things, that the war between Israel and Hezbollah militants may have been planned by Israel, with U.S. knowledge, well in advance of the recent kidnapping of Israeli soldiers. Well, that sent Valerie Spain to the listener line.
I totally agree. I do believe that this is much bigger, and I'm very disappointed that the mainstream media is totally missing how incredible the damage is in Lebanon. And this is not just about the kidnapping of a few soldiers.
Laura Jimenez of Medford, Massachusetts, also called and directed us to a July 21st article in the San Francisco Chronicle, which also claims that Israel began planning the current war a year ago, when it became clear that Hezbollah was stockpiling missiles. But others, like Stephen Blancher of West Boylston, Massachusetts, question Cole's credibility and his reasoning.
I'm calling to criticize Professor Cole's commentary because he conveniently has left out the fact that the head of Hezbollah had said that they had planned the kidnapping of the Israeli soldiers for 5 or 6 months. So certainly he can say that Israel and the U.S. have planned an attack in Lebanon, but he should also be cognizant of the fact that Hezbollah planned the attack or the kidnapping of the soldiers and the border incursion from their side as well.
And of Juan Cole's contention that Hezbollah might have been disarmed through negotiations, Elihu Stone writes, there is no way that Hezbollah would have been moderated like the IRA prior to Israel's defensive strikes. First off, Hezbollah receives its marching orders from Iran, and the IRA ambitions were never to wipe their opponents from the face of the earth, no matter the cost to their own supporters. Well, on a much lighter note, last week we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the air conditioner and maybe celebrated it a little too much. Kay Dolezel of Waltham, Massachusetts writes, I love your show, but found your piece on air conditioning a bit patronizing toward those of us who choose not to use air conditioning. And what about air conditioning's negative impact on the environment, she asks. Point taken. Well, we also celebrated the first radio transmission recently, an effort to give long overdue credit to Reginald Aubrey Fessenden. But in doing so, we stepped right into the controversy over who invented the radio. We said Marconi, but Paul Scott of Tucson, Arizona, wrote to remind us that it was Nikola Tesla who first invented the coils used to transmit radio signals. So in giving props to one overlooked inventor, we regret that we overlooked another. We also spoke recently with the director of the PBS film Al Otro Lado, The Other Side, about corridos, the Mexican folk songs that glorify figures seen as heroic, from the Mexican Revolution to today's drug runners. Well, at least one listener calling from a Boston cell phone said that in airing that story, we glorified them as well.
Hi, Robin. My name is Brian Aguiar. I listen to you all the time. Love it. You guys are great. But I have to say that the piece you just did on the Mexican fishermen, the drug runners, that's crazy. It's like you're okaying drug running just because it's small and they're impoverished people. And to equate them with the glorified heroes of a Mexican Revolution, I'm disturbing also because they were fighters. I have to speak quickly because now I'm heading into the tunnel in a minute. They're just drug runners. It's a
A familiar sound here in Boston as Brian enters one of the few tunnels still open. Finally, thanks to those of you who wrote to tell us that My Cubicle, the online parody of James Blunt's mega hit You're Beautiful, is sung by Jim Britton of the comedy group Morning Sidekick. Everyone, sing along.
My cubicle, it's one of 62. It's my small space. In a crowded place, just a 6x6 foot booth, and I hate it, that's the truth.
As always, we love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now.
But instead, I just sit here and surf the internet in my cubicle. My cubicle. It doesn't have a view.
Hunter opens today in theaters nationwide. The film stars Nicolas Cage and Michael Peña as Sergeant John McLaughlin and Will Jimeno, Port Authority police officers who went to the towers to rescue others, but instead became two of the last survivors to be pulled from the rubble. As the film begins, we're reminded of how little these officers knew and how many headed into the unknown.
All right, listen up. Let me have your attention here. They're telling us it's a commuter plane. Tower 1's being evacuated as a precaution. They've asked us to send a team down to assist. Sergeant McLaughlin.
Got a list of names here. Step out when you hear it. We're going downtown. Pull Nikki.
Sarge.
Colavito.
Sarge.
Washington.
Sarge.
O'Reilly.
Sarge.
Jimeno.
Sarge.
World Trade Center is directed by Oliver Stone, and so his critics have been poised to pounce. They say his past films like JFK, Born on the 4th of July, and Platoon are slanted and bombastic. Would he dare politicize this most sensitive of topics? Well, joining us in the studios here now is pop culture critic Renee Graham. And Renee, what do you think?
They needn't have worried, you know. This isn't some, you know, feverish political film crammed with conspiracy theories. I think, in fact, it's the most rousing film Oliver Stone has made since Born on the 4th of July, except this film doesn't have the political agenda. This is a film about two Port Authority officers trapped beneath the rubble of the collapsed towers. It's not about U.S. foreign policy. It's not about the hijackers' motives, Osama bin Laden or George W. Bush. Mm. He sticks to the stories, and in a way, it's really the 9/11 film that Ron Howard would make.
Yeah. But it's not even just their story. Expand it a little bit for us.
It's the story of these two men, but half the film is spent with the families of these two men, in particular their wives, who are played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, who plays Allison Jimeno.
Mommy!
Hey, baby.
Daddy coming home.
Honey, I don't know.
And Maria Bello, who plays Donna McLaughlin. So we get to see these two men trapped, but we also get to see their families who are getting what news they can from television, from calls they're getting from fellow officers, and just how they're coping with the fact that they know their husbands are there and they have no idea what's happened to them.
It sounds like Apollo 13 in a funny way, you know, where you see the family waiting at home.
There is that. I mean,
yeah,
I suppose he could have made the film just about these men, but you need to have this other element, and that's it. It's not as much of what's happening in the city or anything else. Mm-hmm. It's these two men and how their families are coping with this tragedy.
You know, we've all been intrigued with the two real-life characters, the two men that this film was based on. Does it give you some insight, you know, into who they were before they're suddenly heroically trapped?
You get a little bit of that. But I think what's really interesting to see is, you know, we all remember 9/11 quite clearly, but what this film does give you is this sort of inside view of these officers who had to go to the scene and what was it like for them. You know, they knew this was something beyond what they could handle, and in the scene we're about to hear, that's something that the Nicolas Cage character sets up as he's driving to the scene. He's looking up at these smoking towers and realizing that there's going to be very little they can do.
What? Prepared for everything. Car bombs, chemical, biological, an attack from the top,
but not this, not for something this size. There's no plan. We didn't make it.
Only emergency transmission going to...
Nicolas Cage, of course, the actor, tons of past success, won an Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas. His more recent films haven't had as much critical acclaim. He plays Sergeant John McLaughlin. How do you do?
You know, I've always been of the opinion that Nicolas Cage, sometime after Leaving Las Vegas, forgot how to act. He just hasn't been very good, and he hasn't been in very many good films in the last, it seems, decade. He's not bad in World Trade Center. I guess there's something to be said for having Nicolas Cage confined. He can't move. He can't overact. He spends the better part of the movie buried in rubble. And so he does fine. I think an even better performance comes from Maria Bello, who plays his wife. In a scene we'll hear, she's at the station house, and she just gets frustrated. She's had a very long day, and she's tired of getting confusing messages about what's going on.
Yeah. Hi, Miss John McLaughlin.
Mrs. McLaughlin?
Yes.
He's alive, but I'm afraid there's been a mistake.
Mistake?
When they called me, they really thought John walked out. He didn't. He's still trapped. They're working on it.
Is he hurt, Dad?
Oh. This is not right. This is not right! He gave you everything, years of his life, and you can't even get this right!
Renee Graham, these two men in real life, Sergeant John McLaughlin and Will Jimeno, it is a nightmare to think of what happened to them. I'm not sure I want to see this film because I don't want to feel the claustrophobia that they must have felt. I mean, how does that get across?
You know, you get the sense of the claustrophobia that, you know, you're not seeing their hands waving about. You're really seeing their faces. There's smoke. There's fire. There's debris falling. You know, it's very affecting. But the thing you always have to remember with 9/11 films is, you know, what are you reacting to? Are you completely reacting to what you're seeing on the screen, or are reacting to your memories of that day?
Right. You also saw United 93, which was just released last April, of course, about the what was happening aboard that flight. You, at the time, interviewed director Paul Greengrass, and now we have the Oliver Stone film. How would you compare their approaches?
I think of Oliver Stone's World Trade Center as Titanic to Paul Greengrass's A Night to Remember, which was the 1958 film about the 1912 sea disaster. The 1958 film was very straightforward to the point where it was almost like watching a documentary. And, you know, comparing that to James Cameron's sort of oversized mega hit, the Paul Greengrass film didn't have any known actors. So you weren't distracted by seeing stars. Mm-hmm. You just saw people. I think in that way it made the story even more absorbing. You know, World Trade Center certainly has its moments. I think it's a really well-made film. But I think ultimately, I think United 93 was the more moving and more involving film. Because it never took you out of the moment in the ways that this does with seeing stars or cutting back and forth, right, between family members, and also just Oliver Stone's overuse of music.
Any other moments that jumped out for you?
There is one moment, and it's the moment that reminds you that this is an Oliver Stone film. And in every Oliver Stone, there has to be one completely loopy moment. It's his rendering of a thirst-induced hallucination experienced by one of the officers. And anyone who has seen Stone's films, especially the Jim Morrison biopic, The Doors, knows he just can't resist wacky apparitions. And this one is absolutely strange, and I actually had to bite my lip to keep from laughing out loud.
Do you want to say what it is?
I don't want to say what it is. I want people to be surprised. I want people to just have that moment because it struck me as very odd and took me out of the film in a way that I at that moment didn't really work.
What does the film say about where we are in terms of 9/11 culturally? Is it like, since Oliver Stone made it through, does this mean that it's going to be open cultural season on 9/11 and we'll see a lot more?
I think that happened with United 93. I think you heard all the questions of, are we ready? You're hearing that a lot less now. You know, we went through 93, United 93, and it's okay. There have been no reports with people, you know, running, screaming, crying out of theaters, seeing the trailers for World Trade Center. So I think that already says that we are ready for it. We're ready for the movies. We're ready for books about 9/11. It has been almost 5 years, and it is a part of the cultural landscape. And I think that, you know, I think movies about this, so long as they're done intelligently, like this is, I think it's a good thing.
Of course, there'll be thousands of people who will never be ready, you know, the victims' families. But apparently, in this case, they were closely with the filmmaker and they were happy.
Exactly. So right. I think that's an important thing as well.
Here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham on the new film World Trade Center. It opens in theaters today. Renee, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The bi-local